And good afternoon, assuming that's when you're listening to this. I guess I should never say that. Kyone Wolf has a sore throat. That's why you're not hearing her voice. Although I'm the host of the show, it's appropriate. It's not inappropriate that I should talk. And that may have been a HIPAA violation that I just did, too. Am I allowed to tell people? I'm going to take my chances. She's got a sore throat. That's why she's not here today. We miss her. But we've got a wonderful show for you today here on The Scramble, our Monday show. We are going to talk in a little while to – we're trying – with sort of two different views of Donald Trump, really, that are essentially – that have quite a bit of overlap in their Venn diagram circles, although one comes out rather negative and one comes out rather positive. So the positive view will come later. That's from Michael Goodwin, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and columnist for The New York Post. A self-avowed Democrat, but someone who has announced that he intends to vote for or support Donald Trump. He's also a commentator on Fox News and Fox Business. Anyway, you'll hear about him later. Joining us right now, it really has been a very dark and stormy campaign season, but one of the bright lights has been the emergence of Jamelle Bouie, a chief political correspondent for Slate Magazine, with some really terrific journalism about this. And one that has a lot of people talking right now has been his most recent piece, in which he tries to sort of figure out what's inside, what set of nesting dolls are inside this Trump recrudescence, what's firing it all up. And first of all, Jamelle Bouie, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
And so one of the things that you do think provides some of the engine for the Trump resurgence or insurgence is, in fact, a resentment of President Obama. Explain the connection that you make in your piece.
So the cliche is that after Obama was elected, we kind of entered this post-racial era, this era of good feelings when it came to race. But I think both lived experience, what people have observed in national news and in their own lives, and social science suggests just the opposite, that the election of Obama has sparked kind of a resurgence of racial resentment and explicit prejudice and animosity in American politics. And so I take that sort of as my starting point, and I use quite a bit of social science research to back up this point, that after 2008, there was a real resurgence in this stuff. And I think part of what's driving it, and I guess the way I'd put it to listeners, is that if you buy the premise, as I do, that the United States has this long and difficult and painful history with racism, and also that racism was sort of an organizing principle for American society for a long time, that it broadly determined who got what resources and who got what protection, then, you know, A, the election of Barack Obama was a historic moment in all the best ways, but it was also a historic moment in that it kind of suggested the end to that sort of organized, that end to race as an organizing principle for the distribution of resources. And, you know, in American history and sort of like the history of human existence, when old hierarchies start to deteriorate, there are backlashes. People who were invested in them get very anxious and try to do something about it. And that's basically what I think is driving Trump, kind of the slow buildup of a backlash to this very historic event that has – that at least presages real material consequences in how America organizes itself, where, you know, 40 years from now, 30 years from now, it will be possible to win national majorities, to win power without needing to rely on white Americans, the traditional sort of power case in American society. And if you take that seriously, then it's destabilizing to a lot of people. And it's no surprise that someone like Trump, whose promise is to make America great again, he presents that, I think, in very racialized terms, in terms that very strongly suggest that what he means by great again is he intends to restore white Americans to their proper place in his view. It makes sense that he would find some level of currency among American voters.
So one of the things that's interesting to explore in that connection is to whatever extent white Americans of either the sort of the middle class, the lower middle class, or the working class feel as though the American DNA code has been rewritten in such a way as to disadvantage them. How wrong are they?
I think they're very wrong. I think humans as a species have a tendency to see things in zero-sum terms. And I think quite a bit of what's driving this, that a lot of Americans – and I should say, I should add the other part of this, is we had the Great Recession, the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. And so at the same time that there is this challenging of the racial hierarchy, it was also very true that millions of people were seeing their livelihoods be destroyed or diminished. And so the two things are happening simultaneously, and they just create lots of stress and anxiety. But I don't think racial change or turnover or however you want to phrase it in the United States is a zero sum game at all. I think there has always been, and hopefully hopefully there'll be more potential for people of different races to work together with common aims. The United States, in a lot of ways, is kind of the world's oldest and, in some regards, successful, in other regards, very unsuccessful experiment in multiracial democracy. And I myself, as an African American, is very invested in seeing that succeed. And I don't think success means that whites are somehow disadvantaged at all.
So one of the things that we've seen in the rhetoric of Trump and the rhetoric of his supporters is this kind of post-lapsarian paradise lost notion that something that was good has gone deeply, deeply wrong. And so he says, we don't win anymore. He's going to make America great again. And you hear that a lot. I wrote a column this past weekend which angered a lot of Trump supporters. So I got to hear from them. Some of them I was interested to hear from, and some of them I was frightened to hear from. But that's another story. But one of the things that – so there are all kinds of recurring themes, and some of them tend to fortify your premise. I mean, I heard a lot about Obama. I heard a lot about Black Lives Matter. I heard a lot about people who are somehow able to game the system. There was one kind of Rosetta Stone type email that talked about how Sanders and Clinton are willing to basically kiss butt for votes from all the special interest groups. Now I'm quoting from the email, that support these disruptions, college blowhards that don't pay taxes but expect the American taxpayer to foot the bill for their student loans, blacks who kill each other in large numbers but are innocent victims when they get shot breaking the law, illegal aliens that play the system and the American taxpayer gets stuck with the tab, gays that cause businesses to go out of business because they do not embrace their lifestyle, et cetera, writes this emailer named Dennis. So there you have kind of your Rosetta Stone, this notion that there is this group of people who constitute a problem and who have kind of subverted America's purpose and made it weaker. So I guess I'm wondering how ultimately whoever has to run against that ideology and whoever has to sort of comment against that ideology, how do you explain it a different way?
Yeah, I think attitudes like the one expressed in that letter are very loud and seem like they constitute a large portion of the United States. But I think, in fact, they're probably a distinct minority. And I think most people, you can appeal to them with a sense of basic fairness, with a sense of empathy. And I think you see that sort of on – let's just go – if you go through the kind of the problems the emailer noted, you look at criminal justice reform, for example. For the first time in decades, there's like a real public appetite for changing how we do criminal justice, for changing how we do policing. And if you look at the polling data, sort of beginning with the events in Ferguson in August of 2014, there has been a meaningful change among white Americans who say that the criminal justice system is unfair to African Americans, right? That being confronted with video footage, potentially, knowing African Americans in their own lives, of hearing people's stories has begun to change people's attitudes. And I think for whoever is running against Donald Trump, assuming he's the nominee in the fall, part of running against him will be to de-abstract all of this, to talk about civil rights, to talk about sort of economic disenfranchisement and economic advancement in terms that are concrete, that bring
people into the conversation. I mean, what's notable about Trump, right, is that he doesn't really talk in the concrete. It's all abstractions about us no longer being great, no longer winning, and so on and so forth. So I think that the right counter that to that is to make this concrete, to confront voters with the kinds of actual people who would be harmed by a Trump presidency, and to appeal to voters' better angels and sense of common decency and citizenship.
So we're talking to Jamelle Bouie, by the way, from Slate Magazine. One trope that recurred a lot that I've noticed recently is the phrase, this mess we're in. And a lot of it has to do with, all right, you've had it your way for 8 years. That's actually a quote from a different email that I got. You've had it your way for 8 years and look at the mess we're in. But there was a similar sentiment expressed in the New York Times on Saturday. There was a letter from an evangelical Christian in Pennsylvania. He says, we're desperate for change and direction. And in future columns of the New York Times, I will be looking for reasons that we should listen to you, part of the establishment that got us into this mess. This is also from a Trump supporter. So, you know, it's an interesting question. What is this mess? I mean, if you one of the struggles the Obama administration has had for really 7 years is getting a positive message about itself out. That, you know, obviously the stock market has significantly rebounded since 2008. The jobless rate is cut in half. Energy is cheap. Crime is down. I mean, we could tick through a whole bunch of things like that, observable indices that would suggest that we are in something other than, quote, this mess, unquote. So what do they mean when they say this mess?
It's interesting because I'm not entirely sure. You know, there's a temptation to say that Trump supporters all come from sort of the declining working classes. But a substantial number of them, I think at this point, I think that the polls suggest like a if not a majority, then a plurality are just standard issue middle class people who, you know, were hurt by the recession like everyone was, but have recovered a bit more quickly and are doing basically okay. I can imagine for some of them, this mess may be the high price of college, the high price of healthcare, sort of things that are common across the board. And that's why that's what puzzles me, right? You know, middle class white Americans, or at least a subset of them, are not the only people facing these things. Lots of people are, but not everyone has jumped onto the Trump train. Just them, and so I think, you know, this is why I keep coming back to the role of race into this, because if you try to analyze Trump just from the basis, just from an economic analysis, or just from sort of, you know, the Obama administration didn't do enough. Or wasn't aggressive enough in dealing with the recession and dealing with the housing crisis. You run into the fact that, again, lots of millions of Americans face similar problems and anxieties and stresses. Millions of African Americans, Latinos, so many people are in a similar boat as some of the most frustrated Trump supporters. So why then aren't they embracing someone like Trump? And I think the answer is that for that this mess of sorts doesn't just mean the economy. It doesn't just mean the perception of foreign threat. I think it's a way of trying to communicate a sense that there's something off in how America is currently organized. And, you know, your letter writer touches on this. You know, is angry about Black Lives Matter, is angry about the very rapid acceptance of marriage equality over the past 7 years, of these very serious and momentous cultural changes that for a lot of Americans suggest that, you know, this isn't the country they thought it was. And, you know, I say that from a real place of sympathy almost. You know, I can kind of imagine what it must feel like to one day see yourself and your values represented at the highest levels of American society. And then in what feels like an instant, someone who is utterly foreign to you. I mean, I grew up in southeastern Virginia and in a community that was, you know, substantially African-American. People like Barack Obama are not unusual to me. They fit into my experience. But for a lot of Americans, they are do not fit into their experience. And it, in fact, is quite disturbing. And that is going to that's going to create some kind of blowback. And I think, again, I think Trump, or at least whatever movement Trump is tapping into, is that blowback.
Speaking of blowback, I'm wondering how effective or perhaps counterproductive you feel the current protest movement against Trump is. So, you know, the demonstrations are getting bigger. They're setting up earlier. You are starting to have the things that sound like almost, as you point out, a refight of the rhetoric of 2008. I was not aware of this until I got yet another email, Jamel, mentioning Bill Ayers. I thought, Bill Ayers, what does Bill Ayers have to do with any of this? Well, it turns out Bill Ayers was one of the people. He was spotted among the people kind of organizing against Trump in Chicago. So it's 2008 all over again. We're talking about Bill Ayers. But there is, if you sort of look at the channels that Trump supporters are tuning into on social media and elsewhere, there is this starting to be this trope of silencing Trump. They're trying to silence Trump. And so we've been having a national conversation about the violence that erupts when people feel like somebody's trying to silence Trump. But they're having a different conversation, which is someone is interfering with our ability to organize and hear this guy. And I'm wondering whether that's getting people dug in a way that's maybe not all that conducive to a national conversation. I mean, obviously people have a right to protest, but are these protests working?
Yeah, I don't know. I think that's a really tough question because there is a case for it on both sides, right? That like these that protesting Trump events that have, you know, Trump is inching very closely towards condoning or even inciting violence against opponents. Protesting these events is in some way kind of like self-defense of the body politic, right? Saying that this is kind of an unacceptable thing to have in a democratic society, that it goes beyond questions of free speech and to really, you know, fundamental questions of how what is a legitimate kind of politics. On the other, and this is like I think a much more like, you know, purely tactical approach, maybe you are hardening the views of Trump supporters and making more people, you know, sympathetic to Trump, people who may not really like him very much, but also do not like the image of lefty protesters trying to shut him down. You know, I'm a bit divided on this myself. Mm-hmm. I very much sympathize with the Trump protesters as someone who views that what Trump is stirring up is quite dangerous. I also, thinking in terms of an election analyst, wonder if this is not counterproductive to the goal of beating Trump in an election. What tempers that is the fact that this is no longer 1968, that the number of people who might vote in a backlash against those kind of protests is much, much smaller. And it's not nearly large enough to deliver a national election. So even if it is somewhat counterproductive, it's not so counterproductive as to be fatal, which wasn't the case, you know, in 68 with the demonstrating and violence then.
So one of your underlying theses, or to the extent that anybody's willing to predict anything anymore, and any of us is really kind of a fool at this point to try to predict things, given the way things have gone so far. I mean, one way that this might play out is that it doesn't appear as though, unless he were to radically diversify his voting base, it doesn't appear as though that Donald Trump, if he were the nominee, could win a general election. It just runs counter to everything that we've learned in the last two election cycles. But that doesn't necessarily mean that Trumpism, as you point out, will go away. I was listening to an Italian journalist talking about making a comparison that others have made between Trump and Berlusconi. And she was saying, you know, Italy's really not the same after Berlusconi. It's not like he went away and everything else went away. But everything that he brought in, all kinds of ideas and even modes of expression that he brought in stayed. I think she used the word a coarsening. And so that really is probably the question. Like, let's say this thing doesn't turn out to be a home run. We're going to go to break here in just a second. But before we do, Jamel Bowie, what's the lasting impact of this?
I think the lasting impact of this is that you will have other younger, ambitious politicians try to tap into what Trump has dredged to the surface. The Trump movement is based off of trends that are ongoing. America is continuing to diversify. Our economy isn't quite working for a segment of Americans. And it seems to me very plausible that 4 years from now or 8 years from now or however, you won't get a demagogic type Trump like figure, but you'll get people trying to organize this into a viable electoral base on, you know, different kinds of levels. I would actually look at the 2018 congressional elections to see what this might begin to look like.
All right. We're talking to Jamel Bowie. He's going to stay with us for a few minutes into the next segment as we talk to Michael Goodwin. So let's grab our break right now. We'll come back and have that conversation. All right. We are back. We are having a conversation, as we seem to every Monday, about the Donald Trump candidacy, the Donald Trump phenomenon in American politics. We've been talking to Jamel Bowie, chief political correspondent for Slate Magazine. He's going to stay with us for a few more minutes. We're going to add to the conversation. And I should say, by the way, in the final segment of today's show, as we did last week, I'll just take your phone calls. We'll talk about this. 860-275-7266. Don't call now, though. Michael Goodwin joins us, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and columnist for The New York Post, also a commentator on Fox News and Fox Business, and the author of I, Koch, a decidedly unauthorized biography of the mayor of New York, Edward I. Koch. So, Michael Goodwin, welcome to this conversation. In the beginning of the your piece, you talk about how you're sort of temperamentally and maybe at the level of your DNA code, kind of a Democrat. But almost by process of elimination, it seems, you've begun drifting towards the idea of voting for and otherwise supporting Trump. Tell us about that process.
Well, it really is a process of elimination. I am not a fan of what President Obama has done. I voted for him in 2008, but I believe I was misled by the kind of president he would be. I don't think he ever intended to be a uniter. And I am a big believer that we've got to unite the country, not everybody, that's impossible, but a real national consensus around the big issues, security, budget, debt, the economy, those kinds of things. And so I'm a Moynihan Democrat. There aren't many of us left, unfortunately. But anyway, I looked at the Republican field. I thought that there were a number of interesting, qualified people, intrigued by Marco Rubio, as so many were, Chris Christie, John Kasich, Jeb Bush, Scott Walker. And then there were others whom I admired, but didn't particularly think they would be good presidents or get very far, Ted Cruz in that group. So I thought it was an interesting field. When Trump first got in, I thought it was a joke. I said, you know, I even joked in my column I'd move to Canada. And then when he got serious, I thought, this is absurd. He's really going to ruin a good field. But slowly, as the others all fell away for lack of support, and obviously Trump's theatrics in many ways take precedence over what he's really saying, but when you look at the people he has attracted, he's now got on the order of 7.5 million votes. It is an extraordinary group of people who I believe are, and they certainly believe, have been abandoned by both political parties. And this is largely the working class and the lower middle class across the country. I mean, many of them are white, but not all of them. I think there are pockets of them in cities everywhere. There are pockets in the middle of the country. There are pockets on the coast. And they are fervent in believing that, A, they have been abandoned by both parties, that the Democratic Party is catering on the left and the Republican Party is catering to big business only, and that the working middle class has been left out of the Washington's consideration. That's not to say that politicians don't talk about the middle class all the time, but what their policies actually don't serve the middle class. It's the poor or the rich. And there have been number of studies done, Joel Kotkin among others, called the barbell economy, where you've got big clumps of rich and poor, but very thin in the middle. And that is what is happening to our country, and these people are largely attracted to Donald Trump because they believe he's speaking to them when he talks about trade and immigration and just the concept of pride in America and, as he says, winning. I think it rings a bell for a lot of these people, and they are quite sincere in believing that he is their last best hope.
So you grew up, I mean, you grew up among the kinds of people you're talking about right now. You grew up in a working-class community, small town, central Pennsylvania. So, and there are obviously two ways in which you could interpret your role at this moment, because in many respects, I mean, you have graduated out of that milieu, but you're still looking back towards it. On the one hand, you could say, as you are doing, I guess, right now, this is the closest thing, as flawed as it is, this is the closest thing to an articulation of our real interest, or your real interest. People back home, or you could say, well, this might be another rich guy who's lying to you, that, you know, who doesn't really seem to have any well-articulated positions. I think you said in your column, you know, they seem to fit on a bumper sticker as opposed to a 30-page position paper. So why did you choose the former rather than the latter? Why are you comfortable, while not really knowing quite exactly what Trump's talking about in a really detailed way, why are you comfortable thinking he really can deliver?
Well, just to be clear, I mean, I qualify it somewhat by saying I'm getting there. I'm thinking about it. I'm not fully committed to Trump. And I wish, as I say clearly, I wish there were a more conventional candidate, meaning someone who didn't have this erratic moment, who didn't demonize Megyn Kelly and others, and who had real policies. I wish there was somebody who embodied his appeal to those left-out people, who also was more conventional in other ways. But there isn't anybody. I believe Hillary Clinton is the most dishonest person in public life today. I think if she is elected, that will be a vindication of the Clinton style, of Clintonism. And I believe it's a give-up on the future in terms of ethics, in terms of integrity. I mean, how would we ever hold any mayor or governor or member of Congress to account on ethics or integrity if Hillary Clinton is in the White House again with Bill Clinton? I mean, I just think it's, to me, incomprehensible that that's the best America can do. Now, I recognize the problems with Trump, but I think that the people he has inspired, to me, that's the end of the equation I'm looking at. I'm not so much looking at Trump himself. I'm looking at those people. I think those people are sending a very loud message to the country. And I heard your other guests talking about that before I got on. I mean, these people regard themselves as the silent majority. And they're not being silent anymore. They feel they're left out, and now they want to play. I think that's terrific. We should want all Americans to participate in the political process, and I'm happy that they are. But whether Trump wins, I mean, we don't. It's obviously too early to say. But I think it's a real accomplishment to get these people to participate in the political process. They have not been doing it, so I think that's a wonderful thing.
Jamelle Bouie is still with us. I'm going to swing you back into this conversation. One of the things that I hear in a lot of the conversations that I do have is this notion that really ultimately, if we have a showdown between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, as looks probable, it really is going to be one of those elections in which everybody's kind of playing defense. You know, that although there may be some people who can see Trump as aspirational and maybe some people who can see Hillary Clinton as aspirational, maybe on behalf of women, there are going to be an awful lot of people playing defense, just sort of saying, well, you know, I mean, I might be in that category. I'm not a really real Hillary Clinton enthusiast. I certainly would find it very easy to vote for her, given the alternative of Donald Trump. I don't know. What's your take on this, Jamelle?
So, I think it's interesting that Michael cited the amount of support Trump is getting in the Republican Party as sort of a reason to take him seriously. And I agree, the fact that I think at this point 7.6 million
people have voted for Donald Trump, although I would add that there's no real evidence that these are new people being brought in as much as they're existing Republicans or Republican general election voters coming in to vote into the primaries. But that's still meaningful. I think so. If our premise is that Trump drawing this large amount of support constitutes something new and remarkable and potentially inspiring, then I think that also holds, interestingly, for Hillary Clinton, who at last count has brought in about 8.7 million people. She's won the votes of 8.7 million people in the primaries, more than any other candidate running thus far. So I'm not sure that this is going to be – I think it's going to be a tough election. But I think if we buy that there are going to be people who come out to vote for Donald Trump in a bit of an optimistic way, then the same set of numbers suggests the same for Hillary Clinton. I do want to challenge the idea, though, that Trump is somehow speaking for the American working class writ large. The American working class is very diverse. The white working class at this point is just a plurality of the American middle class, or working class. Many working class Americans are Black and Latino and even Asian American. And if you look at the numbers, Reuters does a rolling poll of Americans. And so it's very helpful because you can kind of see you can kind of narrow down demographics because they're just polling so many people. Trump is held in an unfavorable view by about 62% of Americans with only a high school degree or just a little bit of college. So that to me doesn't seem like someone who is really speaking to the aspirations of the American working class at large. It seems to me that Trump is speaking to the resentments of some members of the American working class, but just as many other ones are rejecting him, and perhaps more.
All right, Jamil Bowie, I know you've got to go to another gig, so thank you very much for joining us today. I'm going to stay here with Michael Goodwin for a second. Michael Goodwin writing for the New York Post about his, limited but undeniable interest in supporting getting there, as you put it, getting there,
yeah.
Towards. So one thing that we're going to be doing a show about tomorrow is sort of asking people to kind of imagine a world in which Donald Trump is president. Is maybe it's 2019. He's going into the third year of his presidency. So and I don't know how fair it is to ask you to be this speculative, but I guess I would like you to imagine one of those central Pennsylvania towns, like the one that you're from and the people that you're concerned about. Imagine that it's the beginning of the third year of Donald Trump's first term. What would you expect or hope to see different in that place? How would it have changed if your fondest hopes were realized?
Well, look, I think the third year would be the crucial year. For example, if there were to be anything significant to what Ronald Reagan was able to achieve economically, let's say, it really was in that third year. There was, as I recall, there was a recession, I believe, in 1982. Reagan takes office in 81. I believe there's a recession in 82. And so I think that that was somewhat of a hangover from the inflation of the Carter years, the tight money that Paul Volcker famously did to get the country back to a stable footing. So to do that, you've got to in effect, take some tough medicine. And so I do believe that there is a certain bubble created now by the economic policies, including the trade and the cheap money and all of these things. So I think there would have to be some reckoning with this current regime of cheap money and open trade. So I believe that by the third year, so hopefully, if Trump were to follow through on his promises, you would begin to see some of the benefits. You would begin to see some more economic growth at home. If you were able to get some tax reform, if you were able to get repatriation of the monies held abroad by American multinational companies, come back to the United States in some kind of tax forgiveness or arrangement, then I think a lot of that money would be plowed into the American economy, so you would see more growth. I mean, I think it's growth equals opportunity. And I believe that part of what we're seeing in this country now, including everything from college people supporting Bernie Sanders to the working class and middle class support of Trump, is a result of the lack of growth, that we are now in what's called the new normal of 2% annual growth. When you look back at Reagan in 84, I believe, I could be wrong by a couple of points, but I believe there was something like 7% growth in one or two of those years, four and a half in others by 84, 85. So you had enormous growth, job creation, people feeling confident about the future, people starting new homes, new families, moving out of the basement into their own place, getting married as a result of that economic independence. So I think that's what you would hope to see, and that would be terrific for all of those small towns, because I think for those towns it would mean more manufacturing jobs, more higher-paying jobs, higher-skilled jobs coming home at good salaries, at good family salaries, good middle-class salaries. And don't forget, Colin, across the country, middle-class and median family incomes have largely been stagnant or declining for the better part of 20 years. And a lot of people have covered that up with debt. They covered it up with credit card debt, with using their home as an ATM. And all of that is maxed out now. So people now need real income. They need to see real income growth. And I think that's the potential of a rebounding economy to provide a lot of growth, a lot of opportunity. And I think that would solve a lot of the country's problems. It would be the first step to building a consensus about what do we do next? What do we do about this debt, this huge debt overhang? What do we do about the entitlements that clearly need to be reformed if they're to be saved? But I think growth would be the first thing that would get the country back to feeling good about itself.
All right, Michael Goodwin, on that happy note, the lights are winking on, back on in central Pennsylvania. Thanks so much for joining us. I should say, first of all, this has been Michael Goodwin from the New York Post, who's written a column about his inching forward towards supporting Trump. I should also say, in the final segment, it's just open phones. It's you and me. We've been doing this on Mondays, 860-275-7266. You've got your anxieties, you've got your fears, you've got your hopes. Bring them out on the air. 860-275-7266. All right, so we're back. Usually right here, Kyone Wolf thanks everybody, but she's home with a sore throat. So I want to say, first of all, get well, Kyone Wolf. I hope you're back in here tomorrow tweeting for us today, at WNPRColin, where you may tweet right back at us. We'd love to have you be part of our Twitter conversation today. That's Greg Hill in the house. Gina Amatruda is running the board for us today. What would be the analogy to having Gina Amatruda? It's like Admiral Kirk showing up to fly some fairly low-level star cruiser on Star Trek, something along those lines. Anyway, Gina Amatruda, who is a Jedi on the board. I just mixed up two movie franchises. I'm sorry about that. Betsy Kaplan produced today's show. We've got all kinds of wonderful interns in there. I can't really see who's in there, but type them out on the screen and I'll thank them. Meanwhile, we've been trying to do this on Mondays, just kind of let you call in about whatever you want to talk about. The number is 860. It'd be good if I knew the number. 860-275-7266. A lot of calls on the board already. I'll just quickly tell you one thing that I've been thinking about, particularly a lot today. I mean, having heard from a lot of angry Trump supporters over the weekend because of a newspaper column I wrote, my initial instinct was to recoil. But now, I don't know. Now I want to know more. I was sort of glad to have Michael Goodwin on. I want to know more about this kind of thinking. You know, what's it all about? Because it's not nothing, right? We may not agree with it. We may not think, or I may not think, that Donald Trump is the proper vehicle with which to address these grievances, even if these grievances are thoroughly legitimate, whether they are or not. I might think a lot of things, but the truth is that sentiment is real to the tune of 7.6 million votes or so far or whatever. So I think it's important to know about it. And I think also it's probably good for the health of our country to try to hear these voices when they're not screaming really bad words or threatening to punch us in the face, I mean. But, you know, hear the other people who support Trump. Why do they support Trump? What's going on here? So here we go. Let me begin by talking to Joan in Goshen. Our number, 860-275-7266. If you can't get on the air, tweet at us at WNPR Colin. Hi, Joan. You're on the air.
Hi, Colin. Love your show. Hey, I'm not a Trump supporter. I caught the tail end of this. And I think what's bothersome is the rhetoric that people keep throwing out. And that's where the emotions come in, because everybody knows what the problems are, but nobody's identified any of the solutions.
Have you identified any of the solutions, or are you just craving?
I'm craving right now, waiting to hear from somebody about what. Yes, we know what the problem is. How are we going to deal with it?
And I think that's a fair thing. So, and among the candidates who are remaining, you're not really seeing anybody who's lining those answers up in any kind of orderly way.
No, I mean, the closest would be Hillary.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, listen, thanks for your call, Joan.
Sure.
You'd like to see the rhetoric toned down. So would a lot of people. thanks for being with us today. Let's go to Tay in Southbury. Hi, Tay. You're on the air.
Yes. Love your show. But, I mean, Hillary is so scary to the Republicans. But not only to them, so many males, white males, you think that Obama had prejudice against them. But what don't they like about her? Well, she lied about Benghazi. They proved they're wrong. But they keep saying it over and over. And remember, it was Hitler that said that. If you lie often enough, long enough, people will believe it. And that is what we are. And so now we've ended up with this real bully. A bully who could be arrested in any other country in the world, who is so strident, and that appeals to the regular male.
Well, the good news from your point of view, I would say, is that Donald Trump is the best thing that could happen to Hillary Clinton, right? I mean, one of the problems one of the problems Hillary Clinton has, notwithstanding what you say, is that she tends not to inspire fervent participation from a lot of people. Some people, yeah, see her very much as the realization.
But that goes along with the lie.
Yeah, I think some of it goes along with a lie, but I think not all of it. And I would say this. I mean, she strikes me as a person who has exercised extraordinarily bad judgment at times. She's a poor campaigner in many ways. And, you know, to have taken taken huge speaking fees from Goldman Sachs, to have engaged the off-site email server, to have 55,000 pages of emails from
and
that server.
And yet when the head of our Republican Party in Congress says that he's not going to pass this new Supreme Court, man. Hmm. In the least, because DNA NRA wouldn't like it.
Or the DNA, for that matter.
Southbury, right next to Newtown,
yeah,
where the NRA is like a dirty wood.
Mm-hmm. Well, listen, Tay, thanks so much for calling in, and I want to get a few more callers on the air here. Here's Bob in Eastern Long Island. Oh, good, that means the Bridgehampton transmitter is working again. That's good. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Hi, Colin. Question relative to the thoughts on an article I saw in the New York Times this weekend about Carrier Air Conditioning moving 1,600 jobs to Mexico, basically terminating those positions in the States. Profitable company. Everything seems to be driven by shareholder return. And it seems to be totally a destructive action.
So your question would be, who's best poised to address that problem?
I'm not sure the problem has really even been addressed.
Yeah. No, I think you might be right about that. I mean, look, this is part of obviously a trend that predates any currently active politician. Some people want to pin it on NAFTA. One thing that I would say, I was thinking about this listening to Michael Goodwin, I think there are limits to which you can kind of unwind the clock or put the toothpaste back in the tube or whatever your metaphor is. I mean, we may have globalized too fast or too profligately, but I'm not sure that we have the capacity to unwind that problem and get it back to its place of origin. And that's sort of, I think that is a little bit one of the myths that Trump is circulating, that somehow or other that you can unring the bell. Okay, I've used 8 different metaphors for that. All right, I have time for 1 or 2 more callers. Here's Niam in New London. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Wonderful show. Listen, all of the candidates are promising new jobs, that they're going to bring America back to its footing once again, when in fact, all of the jobs are moved offshore. There's no new manufacturer. The kids that are coming out of high school and colleges, they have to fend for themselves. They have to be relegated to jobs where the pay is minimum wage. I have kids that are doing just that, college background, out of high school, did incredibly well, but there's no future for them. Now, how this is going to be addressed, I simply don't know, and I don't think any of the candidates know.
I think that's fair, and I would say, first of all, one of the ways in which I think Mr. Trump is sometimes undermined by his own rhetoric is that an awful lot of the products that bear his name, of course, are manufactured under exactly those circumstances. They're manufactured in Bangladesh or China or wherever the labor is cheap and production costs are low. When you ask him about that, he says, well, he simply has to play by the rules that exist now. He'd like to even put in a new set of rules.
The thing is that Trump is fermenting the illusion that he's going to correct all of this problem when he has an even, as one caller mentioned earlier, that this he's created a vague illusion, and we want the smoke and mirrors. We're not looking at the realities that this guy is he's not American in terms of philosophy, let alone a good candidate to run this country. So.
I tend to agree with you, Nia, but I just would quickly say one of the things that America has typically been pretty good at for centuries is inventing stuff, getting ahead of the curve, innovating. It's something that we do really well, and we can continue to do that well. We do continue to do that well on a number of fronts. The global reality is, and once again, this is toothpaste that you cannot very easily stuff back in the tube. The global reality is that a lot of that stuff will wind up, the manufacturing of a lot of that kind of stuff will not be, it won't be possible to hold it on American soil, no matter what kinds of protective trade arrangements you talk about doing. A lot of it is going to be manufactured someplace else. It is a global economy, as one of our other callers. Well, I can put Tony on the air really quickly. Hi, Tony. I've only got about a minute for you, so be incredibly succinct.
Sure, Colin. Hey, I wonder why it doesn't come up more that basically Trump he's a casino guy, and casinos are smokes and mirrors and trying to convince people they can get a lot of free stuff for doing nothing, and that's basically what he says now. And, God, that real smart guy you just had on, your second speaker, really didn't seem to see through that, and that's what scares me, I guess, is smart people seem to be also delusioned by this.
All right. Well, yes, thanks for your call. Anyway, I just want to go back to what I was saying before. If a candidate who could really, I think, maybe give us hope would be the candidate who does emphasize getting ahead of the curve. There's a lot of room for innovation in the years ahead. There are ways in which we have to innovate whether we want to or not because of climate change. There are ways in which we've lagged behind. And we've gotten behind other world economies that have recognized that you have to be very competitive in meeting certain environmental standards when you do construction and stuff like that. Because of our level of denialism about all that, we got way behind about it. But there's behind in that field. But there are opportunities. There's ways to innovate. I'm not really hearing any candidate talk very much about that. I do agree with the callers who said you can't restore the past. You're not going to be able to make it 1960 in central Pennsylvania again. That won't happen. It won't come. Other things have to happen, and there has to be a willingness on the part of leadership to foster and promulgate those other things. So the candidate who gets that message out will do a lot better. Thanks very much for listening today. Thanks very much to everybody who helped out. Always a challenge when Kion Wolf is out, but then we got Gina Matruda. We got the Jedi. Thanks to Betsy Kaplan also for putting together this show today. We will be back tomorrow. We are going to do a speculative show tomorrow. It's 2019. Mr. Trump has been president for 2 years going into his third term. What does America look like?